welcome again to Steve's Speed Shop, powered by 2BR Consulting Automotive, sales, brokerage and acquisition of fine motor cars. These shows are repeats of season three, but they all have a new, an amazing feature in each show. This week, the greatest is all things wedge-shaped, 80s and Italian. But first, when you think of the world's fastest street legal car, you undoubtedly think of names like Lamborghini, Koenigsegger, Pagani, and of course, Bugatti. What you don't think of is a 1970s Vauxhall, which is GM here in the UK, family car with a 2-litre four-cylinder engine. But that is exactly how Andy Frost's car started out, and he's about to have a go, a very credible go, at having it declared the fastest street legal car on the planet. Tell us the story briefly from the very start. Do you remember the day that you bought the car? Who did you get it from?
Some bloke in Wolverhampton. I just knocked his door. It was parked on his grass set side of his house. And I just knocked his door and I said, do you want to sell it? And he said, yeah, I'll sell it, yeah. I said, I'll give you 60 quid for it, and kind of that's where it all started.
And when would that have been, Andy? What
1982.
1982. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what was your intention? What did you want the car for? To kind of go to work and get the shopping?
Just as a car, my friend's dad had one, and I always liked it, so I thought, oh, I'm going to get one day, and I just kind of wanted one to just use every day, and I did use it every day for probably about 10 years, just used it every day, work, got married in it, went on holiday in it, just did everything in it. But at the same time, doing things to it like changing engines and painting it, and like everybody does with cars and stuff. But
so what? Well, they don't. A lot of people don't do that now. It's what people used to do. What engine would you have had the standard on? Was it 2.3 four cylinder?
No, 2 litre four cylinder.
2 litre.
So it was a VX 490. So it was the performance in inverted commas model, which had twin Stromberg carbs and things, but it made a whopping 105 horsepower, I think, at standard.
And a top speed of about, what would...
104 mile an hour.
Just over 100 miles an hour once upon a time. That was a big deal. So what was the first engine swap?
2.3, so that came out of the FE Victor, the later one. So it was just a little bit more cubic capacity, same twin carbs. I was into all chromey stuff then, so it was all chrome and polished and just kind of, because it was from that era.
Well, the custom car scene was a big deal in the UK, wasn't there? I've got a statistic somewhere, which I don't know whether it was true or not, but apparently at one point Street Machine was the third best-selling magazine in the UK after the Radio Times and the TV Times, which were obviously the listing magazines for television.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised, because at the time, yeah, it was a huge scene. It was shows all over the place, and pretty much everybody I knew wanted to do something with a car like that. So, yeah, kind of not surprised.
And obviously here in the UK, I mean, in the States, it's more specialist, and there are niches within niches and weird subcultures within the custom scene.
Yeah.
But here in the UK, it's a very, very creative scene, but it's quite small. And it's always really been associated with drag racing in the UK, hasn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, the scene was kind of Street Machines, hot rods, custom cars, but they would all turn up at one show rather than them having one show for one thing, one show for another. But yeah, drag racing was a really big part of... It's how I found out about drag racing, to be honest, through those type of magazines and the shows.
And would that have been the pod...
Santa of Pod. Course, yeah. It was Santa Pod. No, it was 1987. I first went to Santa Pod, which I guess isn't that long ago in comparison with some of them. But I kind of went to a room what you brung, and then just kind of just completely got hooked, which was maybe a bad thing. I don't know.
So at some point, a V8 must have been introduced to the proceedings.
It was there. Yeah, I went from the 2.3 to a six-cylinder, which was, again, another engine from that range of car. Then it was a Rover V8.
Where did these engines come from, Andy? Because I'm interested.
I think I've got a theory in that once upon a time, cars used to rust really badly, especially cars that were made in Britain, and especially cars that...
And I began with a V.
Yeah, and began... Yeah. Well, Fords weren't that much better either, but they tended not to have a V8. I mean, old Jaguars were... I mean, I've had enough of them myself. They were terrible. I mean, if you were in Southern California driving an XJ6 or an E-Type or something like that, then you'd got a chance of keeping the thing on the road. But here in the UK, they just used to fall apart around you.
Yeah, I mean... I think my the Rover engine that I had came from I think it might have been a SD1, just an SD1, which again they used to rot away and just fail. So I think it just got from scrapyards, to be honest.
There's quite a satisfaction in using an SD1 engine, because for those of us of a certain age, that was very often the police patrol car that would. Bring you over to the side of the carriageway to have a word with you about your driving or riding of a motorcycle. So using an engine out of an SD1, there's some sort of Schadenfreude going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, possibly.
Was it out of a police car? Do you know?
Because
they were so popular as police cars.
I mean, like I say, I got it from the scrapyard, out, stripped, cleaned, painted, put it back together. Because at that time, I didn't have. Well, I just had a real sort of job that didn't pay a lot of money and had young children and stuff, so we had to do stuff as cheap as possible.
Yeah, so you had to do it yourself, so you had to learn how to do things. Often by, I mean, I've told these stories before on this show about going up in size and reboring engines and buying big carburetors and having to go back to a shop full of men twice my age who were doubled up laughing when they realised that I'd put a four-stroke carburetor on a two-stroke motorcycle. And I couldn't work out why it wasn't running right. But there wasn't the internet. There weren't books in the library that told you how to do these things. You just had your mates and maybe your dad who would, you know, be able to advise you. Otherwise, you just did it. And if it broke, you thought, well, I won't do that again.
Yeah, that's exactly how it was. Again, there wasn't Google then. So like Google now, you can Google anything and pretty much get an answer. It was literally, we'll learn as we go along type of thing. So yeah, I learned how to weld, learned how to build engines, learned how to gear everything. I learned how to do everything through doing it and finding out.
So we're up to a V8 by this point, a 3.5 litre Buick derived Rover V8.
Yep.
So we've kind of doubled the horsepower, I would imagine, really, haven't we, by this point?
Sort of. I mean, I'm guessing the Rover engine probably made about 150, 160 horsepower, so not quite double, but nice improvement in the scheme of things. But I'd already changed the axle at that time, because I knew I was going to go bigger after a Rover, so we kind of had an American axle underneath for the look as well, to have that big wheel inside the arch look.
Did you improve the brakes at all and suspension?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Really? That's actually quite rare,
isn't it? Yeah.
Well, most of my mates that crammed a big V8 in it just did that, and then were surprised when it was an accident waiting to happen every time they press the throttle.
No, we had Ventura brakes on it, which was like the 6-cylinder version of the FD Victor, which the Rover didn't weigh anywhere near as much as the Ventura engine, so it actually had a good braking system on there for what it was. And then all throughout the life of that car, I kind of had decent brakes on every car I've had, to be honest, because I've tended to do the brakes and everything else before we did the engine.
Well, were you still using it as your family car?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good reason to have good brakes, isn't it?
It is. It is. Having my children inside the car, definitely didn't want to kill them and stuff.
Yeah. So I'm imagining, I'm going to guess, it was a Chevy small block that went in then, or a Chrysler Hemi. Which one?
Chevy small block was next.
Right.
Which kind of, it's just a natural progression. Again, 1987, we went to Run What You Brung with a Rover engine, and ran the lino cracking 16-second run, and went up against a couple of cars that kind of disappeared into the distance. And when I got to the end, it was like, I don't really want that to happen again.
No.
So yeah, small block Chevy was next, but it was still a daily driver even with a small block Chevy in it. And I actually used to race in a class, but drive the car to the track with a little box trailer on the back, sleep in the car, again, because I didn't have any money. Relatively, everything was done on a budget. Engine was built by me, transmission, and it was a manual transmission as well. I had a manual transmission for quite a long time. So, yeah, we used to just drive it there, sleep in the car, race, drive it back home.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Meridian International.
You are listening to Steve's Speed Shop here on Fab Radio International, and we're powered by 2B Consulting Automotive. Sales, brokerage, and acquisition of fine automobiles. Time now for the greatest. Time for the greatest now, and my guests are Edward Brown and Guy Loveridge. The three cars open for discussion, debate, and maybe a spot of naked Greco-Roman wrestling. I noticed you brought along a large pot of olive oil, Edward. I presume that was, what's that for? Or were we planning a barbecue later with perhaps a nice salad, a tossed salad?
Not in Salford and definitely not today, Steve.
Yeah, it's late May in the northwest of England, but looking out the window, you might be forgiven for thinking it was early February. These are the crosses that we have to bear. Fortunately, the three cars that we're talking about today are closed cars, and they are variously the Lancia Stratos, the BMW M1, and the Di Tommaso Pantera. Edward, how would we define these three cars? They're all from the early 70s.
Absolutely.
They are all... Oh, no, they're not all... They haven't all got the engine in the same place, have they? Because the Pantera...
No, it's mid-engined.
Yeah, mid-engined.
Yeah.
They're kind of gentlemen's muscle cars?
I think they were typical of an era where people were looking at Italian design but construction by specialists. I think if you look at some of the people that were involved in the Stratos, the M1 and the Pantera project... These were really high-quality, world-renowned specialists. There was something there about sort of early 70s cars, the desire to do something different, angular styling, high performance. And this was three manufacturers' interpretation of that remit, either side of the Atlantic, though for the most part, obviously, the Di Tommaso was built in the favourite city of all cars, namely Modena in Italy.
I thought you were going to say Detroit, then.
Or
perhaps Birmingham.
Well, that said, but the request for the Di Tommaso in the first place obviously came from somebody who is well-known, we've mentioned several times before, Cocker.
Because he's one of the most influential men in the history of the motor car.
Absolutely.
Guy, can you help us with a bit of pronunciation here, perhaps? You're an educated, cultured man. Is it Tom Tejada?
Yes, indeed it is. Another epochal figure who has to rank up there with Mr. DeLorean, Mr. Iacocca, Mr. Austin, Mr. Morris even, I would venture to suggest. His impact and his shadow is huge, and he was still involved in shaping the fate of later MGs stroke Jensens up into the early 2000s.
Hell of a list of cars to his name. And the interior,
absolutely,
the interior of the Countach. So Gandini does the outside, he does the inside. Seems to be able to turn the Lancia Y10. You and I, Guy, were talking about that quirky little car only the other week. And here was the man. Here was the man whose hands styled it. Why is he not as well known as Marcello Gandini or Giorgetto Giugiaro?
Because he was an artisan, an incredibly skilled artisan, who put himself out for hire to the highest bidder. He didn't have a restricted design house, art school ethos that made him turn down bread and butter jobs.
He did.
As you say, he turned the Uno into the Lancia Y10.
Mate.
My case rests.
He was the dude who was responsible for the 1982 Chrysler LeBaron, one of the most disappointing cars it has ever been my misfortune to own. I took it in part exchange. Don't look at me like that, Edward. I took it in part exchange, and at the end of the deal, I ended up with a Mustang. So let's not. But I was, in a way, I quite enjoyed driving that LeBaron because it was such a poor car, and you realise that sometimes good people do bad things for money.
Because they're paid to.
Yeah, for money.
We've
all done that. I advertised microwavable burgers. I was the voice of Britain's best-selling microwavable meat product. And when you think about it, how on earth could a burger in the bun, I can say this now because they've got somebody else to do it, how could it possibly all cook at the same time and be an edible experience? But I did it for 7 years, and do you know why? I never ate a single one of those burgers, but by God, the check was nice.
I say it helped pay the mortgage.
Oh, and the rest, pal. It was yeah. So we've all done bad things, somebody. But here
don't
was.
I seem to remember you astride a motorcycle with nothing on but a crash helmet, Steve.
No, it was
well.
A pair of socks. They were waterproof socks. I was referencing Phil, the Prince of Speed Reed's advert for Life helmets from the '70s. All I had on was socks and a Ducati 900 SS to hide my embarrassment. And the strap line was, at least his feet are dry. But let's move swiftly on from the bad things that people do for money and move back to... I tell you what, let's talk about the Pantera. Guy, so you're saying it was Lee Iacocca's idea. How come he ended up with Di Tommaso? Were there presumably the names at the beginning of the list weren't those of the Di Tommaso Corporation, were they? I would imagine he went there and he asked who to build the car. Will we ever know? Would it have been Ferrari? Would it have been Lamborghini? Who do we think?
I believe he touted the project quite extensively to anyone who would listen. But my take on that car is it's a GT40.
Ah, right. Just one second.
And Ford abandoned GT40. They gave it to JW Automotive in the UK to carry on with the racing project. They only built 7 road cars and they looked a bit embarrassed and shuffled their feet, and it couldn't look the same, so it had a redesign. But mechanically, the Di Tommaso Pantera is a GT40.
Edward?
It's interesting because
that means no. That's a politician's way. That is a politician's way of saying no, my friend.
The history books say Lamborghini were involved somewhere along the line, and they actually decided to walk away from the project. So, Guy, you know, I totally get that. You know, it was almost going to an engineering and manufacturer in Europe and saying, this is what the plan is, this is what we want to do. Iacocca had obviously got this vision to take the Cobra for the next step, notwithstanding that in its back catalogue that Di Tommaso had built was something that we were talking about before, the Mangusta or Mongoose, and the Mongoose preyed on a Cobra. And so there was an awful lot of, you know, there was a little bit of one-upmanship at that time, what is now 45 years ago.
7,260 produced for a low-volume car and a kind of a... How was it sold in the States? It was sold as a Di Tommaso, but through Lincoln dealerships, yeah?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the bottom line is it was in production for 20 years. There were 7,000 units sold. The age-old story, racing improves the breed. Sadly, not in this case. there were two attempts to do that with the Group 3 and then subsequently the Group 5. What it really had going for it was initially a big thumping 302 Windsor.
It's not that kind of car. It's not a race car.
No, it's not.
It reminds me, I'll get a take off both of you for this. It reminds me of those kind of cars that Clark Gable used to smoke about when he was at the height of his fame as probably the world's leading moves. Like a Cord or a boat back Cord or something like that. It's a gentleman's, it's a flashy, flamboyant gentleman's boulevardier, a look at me car with lots of sort of fire and brimstone. But if you took it to a racetrack, it really is a fish out of water. It's too wide. It's too heavy. Yep. It's got aircon and electric windows, for goodness sake. It is not a racing car.
No, not at all.
It reversed the adage. Race on Sunday, workshop on Monday with your Di Tommaso, sadly.
That car was get hammered on Sunday and possibly hook up with a minor starlet out of Hollywood, drive up to your place, you know, in Monterey or something like that, and then arrive at the studio on Monday morning, have to be slapped hard before you're ready for your first take. It was a movie star's car. It was a rock star. Okay, Pantera, famous owners, we always come to this. Here's what epitomises the appeal of the Pantera. Three famous owners. Elvis Presley, yep, who reputedly shot his. Does anybody here know the origins of that story?
No, I know that he had one, but not what became of it, other than the fact that he did his utmost to try and blow it up.
Was the wiring
Sunset Boulevard?
The wiring was Italian, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
So he came out one morning, it wouldn't start, and he went and got a 357 Magnum, yep, and shot it a few times, although it was repaired. Second owner, Liv Lindemann, Playboy Playmate of the Year, 1972. and hers was shocking pink. And the third one, Vince Neil of Motley Crue, who infamously, if you've read that, probably the best book about a rock band ever written, The Dirt, crashed his at the bottom, bottom of Mulholland?
Yes.
And actually killed his mate, the drummer out of Hanoi Rocks, and the footage of the wreckage is legendary.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean when I say it wasn't a serious motor car? This was a plaything. This was a toy for rich people who wanted to draw attention to themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. Please don't think that I'm being pejorative when I say that.
Yeah.
And I think I have to say that you're right. It was conceived out of the ashes of a desire, as Edward has rightly said, let's beat the Cobra at its own game. But it was never, you know, who buys a 427 Cobra to go and do the shopping? No one. Who buys a Pantera to do anything bar be seen driving a Pantera?
The design was clever. The styling was fantastic. The transaxle, yeah, Edward, was the one that was the transaxle at the Bora?
Yes.
The Maserati.
Yep. Yep.
I looked at a car and driver road test on this, and they said that as loud as the engine was, and they'd normally put a set of healthy pipes on this thing just to give it the right sort of lumpy V8 to shake the very ground. The noise of the transaxle was so loud when you were driving a Pantera that it overwhelmed that of not just the engine, but the massive tyres that they fitted to this beast.
Yep.
So there was an attempt to make it certainly a well-balanced car, but ultimately, it's not a GT, though. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm kind of struggling with this, but what car would occupy the position that the Pantera occupied in the 70s today? What would you say, Edward?
I think it's very difficult. I think for show and go, there would be some people would say something like a Mercedes SLS GT. Totally different in terms of how it's honed, how it's built, but the type of person that perhaps that it would appeal to, either on the edges of entertainment or somebody who craves something different, that it's that type of, you know, it's that type of car. It's the type of person that would drive around in a wrapped Continental GTC Bentley, that type of individual.
Do you know what it reminds me of? And I'll come to you in a sec, Guy. It's not with us as a production car anymore, but it's from recent times. And I've driven a Pantera and I've driven this car. They reminded me of each other, although in many ways very different. The SLR McLaren Mercedes, that car.
Yeah.
A hot rod, an absolute hot rod from Hades, but still with every creature comfort and refinement that you'd expect. And because the buyers, they're not like people that buy a race car that are willing to put up with the foibles and the indignities and the impracticality. Reliable, of course, which wasn't this the whole reason for the car? Here was an alternative to those finicky, weird exotics from Europe that required a huge amount of servicing, were chronically unreliable. Here was that car, but with a big Ford V8 that would never stop and never go bang. And, you know, you could rely on it to start on a Monday morning.
The only irony in that, all of that argument, is that the car was built in Modena.
Right.
that's the only argument. I mean, if you look at what around and about, whether it's Lamborghini, Ferrari, Maserati, you know, Bologna, Modena, that automotive centre of excellence for all things design, build, engineering, motorsport, And yet you could see where Iacocca was going. You could see what he was very clear about wanting to do, about wanting to have a supercar that was of significant interest to the American market, but equally had the design and styling cues of an Italian automotive house, but equally was really well built and had significant performance.
Yeah, power and power assisted four-wheel disc brakes, rack and pinion steering, that fantastic ZF transaxle, 0-60 in 5.5 seconds, which is fairly respectable for 1970. Although, if you'd spent all that money on... Were they particularly expensive, Edward? Were they kind of a halfway house between the American muscle stuff that was around at the time and European exotics?
And I think that was very deliberate, to be frank. I think it was, again, Iacocca, DeLorean. You know, there were two people who were highly influential 40, 45 years ago. And I think it was all about very deliberately as having... a sector, having a car in that sector that represented really great value.
We were talking about TVR, and it's almost the same thing, isn't it?
Yep.
TVR inhabited their own sector of the market.
Yep.
They created it in a way. It's almost as though you're saying, I'd hate to put words in your mouth, but I'm going to, that in a way the Pantera created this category between homegrown mass-produced muscle and overpriced European exotica.
It definitely opened the door.
Guy, can we finalise one thing about this car? Can we actually set this in stone? Because it's something that's been bugging me for ages. Is this a rear-engine car or is it a mid-engine car? For goodness sake, somebody give me a definitive answer on this.
By a practical engineering definition, it's mid-engine because its engine is within the wheelbase and behind where you sit. But I've always thought of it as rear-engine. So
yeah,
that's fudged on.
Well, shall we say... If the engine is transverse, it's mid-engined, yeah? If it's longitudinal, then it's rear-engined. Okay, right. That's been bugging me for so long. So we sorted that one out. It went on a bit too long, Edward. Like a boxer, like a great boxer of that era.
Maybe it was the Joe Bugner.
Aussie Joe Bugner, who was born in Hungary and lived for most of his life in the UK, but somehow
maybe it was the Richard Watt or the John Conte of the
This is getting very parochial. I was going to expand it out and say it's the Muhammad Ali. It was great. It wasn't. You're shaking your head.
Sorry.
Well, maybe I'm pushing it too far by saying it went on far too long, and by the end of its production, how long was it in production? Like 22
years.
20 years.
71 to 91. It's the same old story, isn't it? I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with the Dodge Viper, multiple incarnations, a redesign, new technology, and a fan base across the globe, but fundamentally... As with most things, the design evolved. It got larger, got heavier, more corpulent, less performance.
Guys, look at listen to this, the specification of this car in 1971. 330 horsepower. That apparently was a massive sort of undersell of the engine power. It was more like 375. 330, they claimed. 0-60 in 5.5 seconds. Top speed, 160 miles an hour in 1971. What else was doing that kind of speed for the... Nothing else was doing that speed for the kind of money that they wanted for the Pantera. Yeah, all right.
No, but I think you could look at other things. I mean, the Daytona was just around the corner, the Miura was already in production. So you could say that for value... Value versus marketplace... That was deliberate. What Iacocca, go back to the same thing, what Iacocca and DeLorean were doing there was absolutely, that was very, very deliberate on their part.
The superbike of the day, you imagine, you're in your Pantera, a Kawasaki Z1, the hottest bike on the planet pulls up next to you. You've got 40 mile an hour on that guy. Once you get up to 120, 125, that's it, end of story. You're going on to nearly 160 miles an hour. When has there ever been a time when there's been such a big gap between the fastest superbike of the day and a supercar like the Pantera? Didn't Ford grab back the production from the Italians, though, because of quality issues?
They did, and they tried to put an enlarged engine in it, a 5.8-litre you know, wins a V8. I guess really, unfortunately, it was probably a case of too little, too late. Di Tommaso had built some great cars before, some really popular cars, limited production, well-crafted, very collectible now, things like the Vallelunga and the Mangusta.
What about the Mini?
Yeah.
Guess who's on one of them? I have. Oh, it was my pride and joy, my Di Tommaso, my Innocenti Di Tommaso. How the hell, just quickly before we move on to the M1, how the hell did Di Tommaso end up owning at various times Innocenti, Maserati and Moto Guzzi? Didn't they themselves stagger from one financial crisis to another? How did they accumulate so many other sort of fiscally challenged Italian marks?
I think that for me, I'm sure Guy agreed, that's a big thing. Alejandro Di Tommaso, who was raised in Argentina.
Hence the colours on the badge.
Absolutely.
The blue and white.
One of Argentina's wealthiest families, who chose to make his living in Italy, had a plentiful supply of cash. And actually was involved as a race car constructor, an automotive manufacturer for a period of almost 30, 35 years. And there is a significant contribution to both the motor industry and also motorsport.
They built the first Williams, didn't they, Guy? Di Tommaso, the first Williams race car.
The Di Tommaso, yes. The car that killed Piers Courage and put Frank Williams out of business for a while until Mr. Wolf helped him out. Yeah, Di Tommaso, as Edward has said, was richer than God, if you like, and he was able to step in and help. I don't think he ever had any long-term ambitions to remain Mr. Maserati, Mr. Innocenti, but he was there and able to help. But picking up on your point about the gap between superbikes and supercars, Steve, not since, I would argue, the mid to late 1950s. Has the gap been so wide? What was the Black Shadow topping out at compared to an XKSS, for example?
An XKSS? Well, I think Guy Loveridge, previously a value contributor to this show, you're just showing your ignorance there, pal. Because a Black Lightning, let me tell you, my friend, I've been out on the Great North Road with my pals Ted and Norman, the Vincent test drivers, and we were on a Black Lightning, and a Black Lightning was guaranteed to do 140 miles an hour in 1952. So
KSS would do 200 in 1956. So there's your gap.
That's why we have this guy on the show. Yes, pun intended. Gentlemen, the BMW M1. Now, Edward, did they ever make it in any colour except orange?
Afraid so.
Oh, damn it.
Yeah.
Well, the one that was in my top trumps pack of supercars was orange.
Yep.
And then when I actually got to drive one at Munich Legends, which is a very well-known and well-respected British BMW specialist car dealer, that was orange as well. I've only ever seen orange M1s.
Over half production, nearly, 45% of production was white, dark blue, red, orange,
yes.
Grey. Black.
Grey? There were grey BMW
there were
M1s.
Grey BMWs, there were black, and there were two cars that were silver. And one of those is owned by a very well-known principal of the F1 movement currently.
Bernie Eccleston. Right, so is it silver, is it? Right, OK. Giugiaro, it's distinctively Giugiaro designed this car, isn't it? You look at it and you think, we're talking before or after the Esprit?
I would say, actually, almost that one of its closest contemporaries
exactly
the
same time.
Is the Esprit.
Yeah. Produced by BMW from 1978 to 1981. Why, Edward? Why did BMW make this car at that time? It doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
I think for them it was a departure. It was something, their history of building supercars, they were far better known for great performance in road cars. Maybe the closest that they'd come previously as a modern incarnation, which was then, about 5-7 years old, was the 2002, the 2002 Turbo. And this was a departure for them that actually BMW was not repeated until the current i8.
I wonder if Guy's got a take on this, because I'm thinking Within the company BMW, there would have been those guy who thought that this was a bad idea, that they should have been concentrating on consolidating the position that they'd established with the O2 series, a fantastic saloon car. I mean, there was nothing to touch an O2, really, from European manufacturers in the day. Would that have been why so few were made, Guy, and why so little effort and money was put into the M1 programme?
The 2002 series of cars and the motorsport high-performance road car sharp end of it had shown BMW that they could compete. Remember, to put it in context, they just fought the battle with Ford, the RS3100 Capris and the RS26s had steamrolled everything until the 2000 Ti had managed to find a DTM niche. I sat down and had a long conversation with the late Karl-Heinz Kalbfeld about exactly this, why the M Sport program came into being, and it had to have a product. BMW management demanded a product rather than an ethos. It wasn't like Ford with RS, which could be applied across the range, the RS 2000 Escort, the RS 1600, the RS 3.1 on the Capri. BMW wanted a product that was new to hang it on, and that's where the inception of the M1 came from.
Mm. Two-door coupe, rear engine, mid-engine again. Can't decide which one it is. Rear-wheel drive, 3,500 of your European CCs, a five-speed manual gearbox. Edward, tell us about the Pro Car Championship. This was an amazing thing, wasn't it?
Pro Car was a vision of Jochen Niersbach, who at the time was head of motorsport for BMW. The idea being to take the current Formula One drivers, put them in the same car, and there's a means of making more interest for the spectator over a Grand Prix weekend, particularly at a European race. The idea was that 20 of them all raced together, a bit of a crash fest in some cases by all accounts, but nonetheless there were two seasons of it with almost 50 of the 450 BMW M1s built were Pro Cars. Niki Lauda.
What, the first one?
Yeah, absolutely. Niki Lauda was the champion in 1979 and Nelson Piquet in 1980.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine now if they said, Lewis, yeah, never mind that car. Come over here. Right, get in this one. I mean, here's the problem. It, as you're saying, it was a crash fest. Well, it was going to be, wasn't it? Because no one's got an engine advantage, no one's got a tyre advantage, no one's got a downforce advantage.
Yep.
Presumably, this was just like half the field going into the third corner alongside each other. And inevitably, when Formula One drivers are involved and they've got lots of metal around them, this is a metal body car, isn't it? We're not talking a fibre body car here.
No.
No, when they've got lots of metal around them, they think, oh, well, I'm completely invincible in this closed car. So it was kind of the most expensive, fastest demolition derby and ever imagined, ever dreamed of.
Absolutely, and as I'm sure Guy had agreed, that Tom Walkinshaw tried to do the same thing some years later with the Jaguar XJR program, and that only lasted a season. And that was the time when it was Derek Warwick, Eddie Cheever were in Formula One. But this is a time when I think maybe there's an awful lot of people, me included, you know, growing up in this environment, who can remember Pro Car and thought, yeah, this is crazy good. This is really exciting.
Absolutely.
It adds to the show. It makes the people more accessible. You know, nowadays, you know, the Monaco Grand Prix is this weekend. Everybody knows what the environment of like is that. Whereas there's an awful lot of people who want accessibility, spectators. And that said, there was an awful lot of ego at work here, but equally there was an awful lot of problems with sponsorship, particularly between the crossover between sponsors in a Formula One car and sponsor livery on a Pro Car.
I've just sneakily looked up who did the art car guy, and I was going to say, wasn't it Andy Warhol? But it wasn't Andy Warhol, was it? He did the E34, Andy Warhol. Do you remember the M1 art car?
Was it a load of Jackson Pollocks?
Moving swiftly on, gentlemen, to the Lancia Stratos. Now, Edward, you've got a sort of a theory that ties all these three seemingly very different cars together.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a correlation between the fact that they weren't a mainstream design house was involved. So variously Bertone, Giugiaro and Ghia. So, you know, somewhat more niche styling houses. In the case of the Stratos and also the Di Tommaso, there's an Englishman who's involved in the engineering
Mike Parks.
And the refinement of both, which is the former GT racer with Maranello Concessionaires here in the UK, the late Mike Parks.
Who, just one second, whose father, Guy, Mike Parks, ran which British car company?
Ran what?
Which Mike Parks' father ran which British car company?
Pass.
Wasn't it Alvis?
It was. Yeah.
It was.
Was it? Right.
Yeah. Guy, the Lancia Stratos. It's easy to get blasé about cars when you're in the game that we are, but I've got such a seriously ridiculously juvenile horn for the Lancia Stratos. It's ridiculous. It's just one of the most desirable cars ever made, surely to goodness.
Well, it is. I mean, it is one of those rare occurrences that we hardly ever talk about on Speed Shop. It is greater than it was by a very, very, very long way. It was a homologation exercise to get that particularly lovely engine into as many cars across the Agnelli Group's portfolio, if you like. It went into the Ferrari Dino, it went into the Fiat Dino, it went into the Stratos. I had the incredible pleasure of driving the checkered flag rally Stratos on an airfield in North Yorkshire many years ago.
Wow.
And I still grin and have other things happening when I think of that afternoon.
The Stratos weighed between 900 and 950 kilograms, depending on its configuration, with a power output of between 275 bhp for the original 12-valve version, 320 brake horsepower for the 24-valve version. What an amazing car. But of course, Edward, horrible to drive on the road.
The best thing I can describe is like driving a motorised bomb down the road. I think that, the closest a decade on is the F40. Great in a straight line, but don't you dare put your foot down when it's not in a straight
modern
line.
Equivalent, the Noble.
Yep.
Similar ethos, just pure driving.
Yep.
No assistance, no concessions to practicality, noisy, uncomfortable, hard to get in and out of, but utterly, wonderfully, magnificently desirable.
Yep.
It's just such a sexy car. The guy was a genius, wasn't he? The guy that styled this car is. I mean, it's a big word to use, but genius. Here's the Stratos. Look at it from any angle.
Yep.
It hasn't got a bad angle. Head on, from the rear, side on, three quarters. It looks awesome from directly above. Has there ever been a car that's looked good from so many different angles?
It's purposeful to an end, isn't it? I mean, the bottom line is, if you look at how this car developed, you know, first and foremost, I'm a racer at heart, and that's an environment, whether it's racing or rallying. Three times a world champion.
74, 75, 76 with Sandro Minari and Bjorn Valdegaard.
Still winning world championship rallies in 1981 with Bernard Darniche.
He'd only got pulled out of rallying. Would it have had more success if the politics of the Fiat Group had been different? Because, Guy, didn't they pull it out because they wanted to promote the Fiat rather than the Lancia in terms of rallying?
Well, no, because the 037 happened, which was always a Lancia. It suffered because of the global sea change in rallying at its peak. That was what killed it, really. And it was clean sheet of paper time rather than evolve. It was reinvent, unfortunately.
It raced at Le Mans in the 24 hour.
Finished 20th with one of the foremost lady drivers of the time, the now sadly late Lila Lombardi.
The more I learn about this car, the more I want. And what colour? Come on, guys, what colour? Guy, what colour is your Stratos?
Alitalia
colours. Same as you, Edward.
It's a Stradale in orange, the rally car in Alitalia colours. And I think there's an interesting thing here. 40 years ago, European Rallycross. Remember that? Murray Walker, Sunday afternoon, Lyndon Hill on the TV.
Absolutely.
Right.
I inherited that gig.
You did?
I inherited Murray's commentary gig in Rallycross, yeah.
Right, OK. Two people, first and foremost, in European Rallycross at the time, alongside Martin Shanker, were Alexander Wurz's father, Franz Wurz, and Andy Bentzer. And Andy Bentzer, guy, was one, an individual who took over an ex-checkered flag at Rally Stratos. Now, that car... there's something unique about that car because it is the only 3-litre Stratos ever built. And would you believe that 40 years on, that Alex Wurz, son of Franz Wurz and former Formula One and Le Mans driver, has purchased that car a couple of years ago and it was finished 3 weeks ago. And it now is now part of the Wurz family collection once again.
Those wheels, those five-spoke gold...
Absolutely.
Campagnolo wheels.
Yep.
Surely one of the greatest wheels ever put on a motor car. Pure sex with the magnesium.
Yeah. A friend of mine had a Ferrari Boxer, a 365, and he said, I said, why have you got this car? And he said, I'd love to sit in the garage and look at the wheels. And I said, well, what about the car? And he went, not really that bothered about the car. It's just the wheels.
They were very, very sexy. I'm not normally a fan of the gold wheel. I think it doesn't half date a certain car. Subaru WRXs with gold wheels don't quite do it in the same way, but an orange, an acid green Stratos with those gold five-spoke wheels on. Oh, just pure sex. Let's talk values before we do 3-2-1. Edward, you'll probably have a good handle. You both have a better handle on this than me. I mean, the Stratos, massively... more produced, massively more of them made than I do the other two. In fact, the other two between them amount to what in terms of the M1 and the Stratos?
Well, there is irony here again, is that if you look at the Stratos and the BMW M1, the combined production doesn't actually represent 20% of Pantera production. So that's the real surprise.
We're being a little unfair, aren't we, comparing two handmade cars with a mass... effectively a mass-produced car.
Yeah, there is another thing, which is, of course, that the Stratos is the one where it's been interpreted through replicas. You know, there are several kits that you can buy domestically here in the UK.
And very good, some of them.
Very, very good. Yeah, absolutely.
I've driven their cars. Yeah. Very good kit.
Transformer, Hawk, Lister Bell, Napier Sport, all making really strong kits.
And, of course, you stick a 24-valve Alfa V6 in there.
Yeah.
And... are we being kind? Should we be recommending that people drive replica cars?
Yeah, but the bottom line is...
Is it like sleeping with your sister? Come on. It's not a thing. It might be fun at the time, but if somebody sees you doing it, I mean, come on.
The bottom line is that this is a car now which went through a bell curve. You know, used car, nobody wanted them, everybody was into other things. Now, of course, the Stratos in the last 5 years has now got back with a value of round about, give or take, £400,000 sterling.
I was there when Rowan Atkinson, yes, Mr. Bean, bought one from the Autodrome. I was there with my friend Simon Duval-Smith, who's been on Speed Shop, and they sold Rowan Atkinson an orange Stratos Stradale for £38,000. That would have been about 25 years ago. He took it back within a week. Took it back within a week, couldn't get on with it, hated it, threw it back at them. I think they gave him £25,000 for it.
The other thing is that imitation being one of the best ideas of flattery is that Guy probably well knows that in 2005, one of probably the world's foremost Stratos collector, Christian Hrablec, decided to actually reproduce the Stratos. Sadly, it's all unfortunately become a significant legal internal family issue. But nonetheless, Hrablec at the time owned both the prototype and also the 1973 Safari Rally winner.
Didn't I see this car on the world's most popular car show?
Yep. And rightfully so. I mean, you know, people talk about the F40, but go back 15 years, And the Stratos absolutely has to be there. A German guy, German industrialist, Michael Stoczek, he used a platform of an F430, a Ferrari F430, to, again, and this was, what, 6 years ago, to come up with his own interpretation of it. And ironically, at the time, Ferrari encouraged their suppliers and engineering partners not to support Stoczek with his plan. Now, there's something that's interesting, something very curious about that as to why they would do that. But there are several people who have actually tried to come up with their own imitation, their own new millennium take on the Lancia Stratos.
So 400k for a Stratos, how much for an M1?
Pretty much the same.
And a Pantera?
An awful lot less. Yeah.
We'll call it in a second, but here's something I want to ask both of you quickly. We've got an M1. We've got the modern version of the BMW M1, the i8. That surely is the modern evolution of the thought processes that went into the M1 back in the early 70s. Why the hell haven't we got a modern Stratos or a modern Pantera? You first, Guy.
I suspect because there is no appetite within the industries that spawned those two ideas to revisit it. I can't see the Italian car industry, given that Ferrari is that brand, given that Lancia don't even sell in the UK anymore, given that they are now Chrysler Jeep as well, there is no appetite for it within them corporately.
What about a two-seater Stratos lookalike, a 21st century version of that guy, with the new, what's that motor that's in the new Giulia, the Alfa? It's like a 450 brake horsepower. What about something, would that not sell? And what about a price point, both of you, between the sort of Ghiardos and the most affordable 458 or whatever, and the most affordable Aston? What about something that was coming in at about, in sterling, about 75,000 to 85,000 new? Isn't there a home there for a modern version of the Pantera, a modern version of the Stratos? Who's got that market now, Edward?
I think we're about to see. To be frank, I think just around the corner, Sergio Marchionne, through the Fiat Group, I think we're likely to see it in the next 12 months with the new Dino. There is talk that there's going to be a lot of shared platform of the Alfa 4C.
Right.
And I think probably we've been without that marketplace. And I think for people that maybe can't afford a Diablo, Gallardo, but still want the thrill, then probably the idea of having something in their interpretation, is probably the Alfa 4C.
Yeah.
And I think domestically for us, albeit financed elsewhere, is probably the Lotus Elise or Exige. There's definitely an overlap in those type of cars. I think maybe what you could see is the Stratos was all hair and teeth. It was uncontrolled. It was, most of the people that drove it were out of control.
So unlike us.
Yeah,
well, all hair and teeth.
Well, you maybe because you had your brown flares on at the time when you did it.
We're a little bit challenged in that department, all three of us. So that'll be interesting to look out for. Gentlemen, we're running out of time. I'm going to ask you, Guy Loveridge, to call it 3-2-1 as ever, sir.
The Tommaso in third.
Oh.
Despite the fact that it is by far the most common.
Guy,
in this company.
Guy sales figures Loveridge puts the D Tommaso a sales success in third place. Go on.
Stratos in second.
Ooh.
M1 in first because of what it gave birth to and the fact there's still M badges on the back of BMWs today.
He makes a very good point, doesn't he, Edward? Please call it 3-2-1, sir.
Yeah, he does. The real shame about the Di Tommaso is that there were some great people involved in that car, and the 20 years of production from Lee Iacocca, from Alejandro Di Tommaso, from Tom Tejada, there were some, even Giampaolo Dallara, the race car constructor, who subsequently partnered with him. But sorry, no, in third place, the Di Tommaso Pantera. Secondly, the BMW M1. You could understand completely where Nierspach was, what they were trying to do. I think it was a high point. There are those that talk about running, owning and maintaining a BMW M1 not being an easy experience, that notwithstanding that a lot of the switchgear was concurrent on the M635 CSI. I had a great time in motorsport. Ironically, that there are several examples still running in World Endurance Sports Car Masters now in historic racing, highly effectively.
How many miles must they have done competitively, those cars?
Absolutely.
Phenomenal.
Absolutely. Ironic that at the time that it's almost they were passed by in motorsport, save for pro car, and yet now here they are so much more heavily involved in historic racing. And undoubtedly, I'm totally with Guy, the Lancia Stratos, absolutely one of the most iconic cars of the 20th century. Maybe not unlike the F40, relatively badly built, but great fun, huge performance. And the idea of Munari, Darniche, Bjorn Valdegaard, the late Bjorn Valdegaard was another one, singing through the trees in a Stratos, an opposite block. That's isn't that what it, the passion that we're all involved in? Isn't that what it all about?
So I've got the hairs on the back of the neck.
You just paint it. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Anybody who wants it should go to YouTube and listen to the sights and sounds of the Stratos in a forest, and they'd understand why unequivocally that the Stratos is number one.
Well, quickly, a car that was owned by variously Elvis Presley, the Playboy Playmate of the Year, and my missus is going to be furious, Tim Horton, Canadian icon that he was and is, should be in third place. Seems quite ridiculous. But in this company, I'm afraid that's where the Di Tommaso Pantera will have to reside. In second place, the BMW M1. Oh, just an amazing car. I mean, it happened at the right time. I was a very impressionable boy of 7 or 8 years old. I remember seeing it in my grandfather's copy of Autocar and Motor magazine, which he kept in binders in a specially made bookcase that he had especially crafted to contain his magazines. I would endlessly pore over the stories, look at the exploded drawings, which of course were a feature showing all the technical. You never see those in car magazines anymore. They do a double page spread, a huge exploded drawing of all the car's mechanicals, the suspension, the engine and everything like that. Just what a piece of kit, and laid the ground ahead for the M series. I mean, how significant is that? But I have to say, it's just one of the greatest cars. I think it's going to be there right at the very end when we're talking about the greatest car. I think it's going to be up there with the Mini and the Beetle and the Model T and the Jaguar E-Type. A brilliant race car. Just, to me, it's like the... A Lancia Stratos is like David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. It's just like so evocative of its time. And I don't know, as in if... I tell you what, late 60s, early 70s, whether we're talking about music, whether we're talking about film, whether we're talking about anything creative. And this car is the product of creative minds and a creative process. I don't know we will ever top that time in terms of creativity. And for me, no car epitomises that time better than the Lancia Stratos. Extravagant, flamboyant, outrageous, exciting, vital. The Lancia Stratos. What a car. But it's not up to us, it's up to you. Thank you, chaps. Thank you, Guy. Thank you, Edward. A pleasure as always.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
That's it for Steve's Speed Shop for another week. Speed Shop, of course, is powered by our good friends at 2BR Consulting Automotive, sales, brokerage and acquisition of fine motor cars. See you next week.